Hello and welcome to David's Book Talk, and today we have a very special guest. He writes a mystery series set in Wyoming. His name is Craig Johnson, and his new book is called Junkyard Dogs, and it is just out from Viking Penguin Publishers. Hello.
Hey.
How are you?
Good to be here.
It's good to have you on. Finally, I've never had you on my show before. You're a rookie.
I am. Like, it's a nice opportunity. For a guy who lives in a town of 25.
Right, 25. You really live in a town of 25 people?
Well, I live on the outskirts because the hustle and bustle of downtown U-Cross, Wyoming, got to be too much. So I kind of had all the traffic and the noise and everything. I had to move to the outskirts of town.
You like quiet.
I do.
Nothing wrong with that. I like quiet.
Maybe, I don't know, maybe a quarter of a mile away from an intersection of U.S. 1416, like that. And that's where the actual town of U-Cross is, about a quarter.
Is it a good place to write?
Yeah, I think so. Like, it's quiet, you know, and, you know, it allows me a certain amount of focus, you know, that I normally, you know, wouldn't have, I think, in a very large city. And, you know, I mean, I like city life, don't get me wrong. Okay, the majority of my, you know, youth was spent in metropolitan areas and stuff. But I think when it finally came time to settle in and you know, and try and do something, I think I always wanted to, you know, build my own ranch, and I always wanted to have my own place. So I think this lends itself to me pretty well. Like, I mean, I remember living in New York. I remember living in places like, you know, Philadelphia and Chicago and all that. And there always seemed like there was so much going on.
Right.
That, you know, I wasn't, you know, availing myself to, you know, that I felt guilty most of the time. And so, you know, when you live in northern Wyoming, there really aren't that many, you know, cultural distractions. So.
Do you get a lot of people that come through?
Oh, yeah.
I
do. Look, I mean, you know, we're right, you know, right in between the Black Hills. I'm over in South Dakota and Yellowstone, you know, which is over on the western part of the state.
So what's the temperature today there? What's the temperature today?
Oh, it's a nice day today. It's like up in the 70s.
Oh, wow.
We're having a really nice warm day today.
And it's nice here, too. It was really humid yesterday.
We don't get the humidity.
You're lucky. I'd like to give you some of ours.
We're up around like about, you know, a little over 4,000 feet, so with the altitude and everything. And this is, you know, generally, you know, it's the high plains. A little bit like a high desert.
It's easy to tell your books. All your the covers are very similar. I assume they do that intentionally, so people know.
Quite a battle there for a while. Like that, you know, not a battle between me and the publisher, but the publisher with themselves. They weren't quite sure, you know, how to portray the books. I think, you know, and so they were literary, but you know, they were mystery. They were funny. They were, you know, all these different things, and so they were trying to find some way. To convey that. So we went through about three different types of covers, you know, for the initial book, The Cold Dish. And then we finally settled on this one artist out of Nashville, I believe is where he's from. Like that. And he does these, you know, really graphic style, you know, artwork. They tend to, to me, they kind of look a little bit like the old WPA posters, you know, old works projects.
Right, right.
With a kind of like strong graphic.
So you like them?
I do. I have to admit that I do like them. So they don't look like every other, you know, mystery thriller that's out there. The only request that I made was, please do not use blue tinted photography with chrome lettering. Was the only thing I begged, you know, because it just seems like every time you turn around up there on the bookshelf, that's what you see.
Well, just opening the book yesterday, it really catches the eye. I think it really looks nice. And
yeah, this might be one of the best ones so far. I mean, it definitely, you know, has a lot of dramatic tension.
And I have been hooked on this series ever since I read Cold Dish, and I can remember sitting in back of a Wawa reading the rest of this Cold Dish book and just having the time of my life to sitting there enjoying myself reading this book. And that's the way I feel when I read your books.
Well, thank you, sir. I appreciate that a great deal. Now, I wonder how many people who are like listening to this interview know what a Wawa is.
Yeah. Do you know what a Wawa is?
I do know what a Wawa is. Not only do I know that it's a convenience store, but I also know that it's the Delaware Indian term for Canadian goose.
Is that right?
Yeah, that's why their emblem has the two geese on it there. Boom, boom.
How, that's pretty cool. I'm learning something.
I can't believe that a guy from, you know, Wyoming has to explain this to a guy just outside of Philadelphia.
I just never thought, I never knew what Wawa meant. I always thought it was a place where they had milk. And you're right, the geese, I didn't even think of that. But now I understand. I guess I'm a little clueless sometimes with background stuff like that. I don't think about it, I guess. It's just always been there, and I, you know, you just never think about it.
I remember when I was in Philadelphia, I just thought it was kind of an odd name for a convenience store, and so I did a little bit of research to try and find out, you know, what exactly it meant.
Now, there is a severed thumb in this book?
There is a severed thumb in this book.
So, did you decide to put a severed thumb in before you started writing, or was it just like, I'm going to put a severed thumb in this book?
Oh, no. It was, my books, I tend to, you know, really, you know, do a lot of outlining, very finely detailed outlines for the books before I ever sit down and start writing them. And I knew that there was going to have to be, you know, something of a wild card, you know, in this investigation that was going to turn out to be, you know, one of those dominoes that kind of trips everything all up. Because if this thumb had not been found, if this digit had not been found out at the junkyard, it's quite possible that the people involved with the main crime, you know, in this novel might have got away with it, you know. And so,
right.
You know, and a lot of times that's, you know, kind of what you depend on is just a little bit of luck, you know.
So that one mistake that the criminal makes.
Yeah.
That brings him down.
Yep.
And I think that, and what's fascinating is figuring out what that is in a lot of books. And, you know, and it's amazing how that, it's a little puzzle for the reader to figure out. And
oh, absolutely.
And you need to use your mind when you read. I mean, now these are all these have been in first person?
Oh, yeah, they're all in first person. But I also wanted to agree with you on that part, too. I mean, I'm not so sure that, you know, all reading should be passive entertainment. You know, I mean, for me, it's a big thing, you know, to get people involved, you know, with the story.
Right.
And then going back to your next question, you know, a lot of ways, you know, it seems to me the first person is a pretty miraculous, you know, way of getting people involved with a story. I mean, some of the best stories I've ever heard in my life have been first person, you know, where somebody says, you know, well, here, let me tell you what happened to me last month, you know, and they start in and tell you that story. I think there's just an energy that's there that lends itself really well to the novel. And then the other thing is, as far as crime fiction is concerned, it lends itself to that very well in the sense that, you know, you can meter out, you know, the information the same time that the character is getting it, the reader is getting it. So it's kind of, you know, a nice way to be able to play fair.
Right. I've always been annoyed by books that start out and then go back in time. I don't, for some reason that annoys me that the story's already happened and I didn't know it. I don't know. Am I weird like that? But that's just...
I don't know. I mean, I've got two novels that actually use that a little bit. I mean, the one was Another Man's Moccasins. You know,
right. But I don't get annoyed by your books, though. So it's
thank you. I hope that's the case. Look, I think it's all in how you handle it. I mean, you know, you want to make it so that it's, you know, it's like two stories that are being told consecutively. And you don't want to withhold information or lord it over the reader.
Right, and also if the person's narrating, you know they survived too. So you've already
So you do have, you know, a built-in advantage as the reader in that situation. Yeah.
Well, and I mean they do it in movies. There was a movie with Kenneth Branagh one time where it just kept going back and forth in time. I can't remember Dead something. I can't remember the name of the book.
Yeah.
Dead Again, I think it was called. But it, yeah, I mean, it's just confusing after a while.
It was. But who was his wife in that?
Yeah, Emma Thompson, I think,
Thompson.
At the time.
Emma Thompson in anything, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, exactly. She's one of those actresses that just really can do anything.
Absolutely.
And do it well. Do all of your books take the same amount of time to write, or have there been some that took... I mean, Cold Dish seems like it's a longer book than the others.
And it was. I mean, it had the benefit of being, you know, the initial, you know, foray into, you know, this fictitious Absaroka County and this world that I developed, you know. And I think that, you know, with a premier book, you know, a debut book, you can take more time in the, you know, in the development of not only character but of place, you know, and you know, people will have more tolerance for it than they will, you know, if you continually do it, you know, as the books go on. But I think that, you know, you find different things to elaborate upon, you know, as the series continues. But as far as, you know, like the amount of time that it takes to write the books, you know, it varies. You know, some, you know, take a lot more research. I mean, Another Man's Moccasins, you know, I mean, an entire half of the book took place in 1967 in Vietnam. And it wasn't exactly, it wasn't as if I was writing about the Crimean War. I was writing about the Vietnamese War. So
right.
I had to be very careful and make sure I had all my tent stakes pounded in really good to do what I was talking about, because it might be really annoying.
Did that take a long time to get it all straightened out?
I don't know if it does or not, because, I mean, I'll be honest with you, I generally start research on a book, you know, at least a year in advance, you know, and start, you know, reading, you know, toward the point of writing that book a full 12 months in advance, because, you know, that's one of the joys of being a writer is you get to go and do research on things that interest you, and you get to call it work, you know, rather than just leisure.
So you're organized enough where nothing, when you're writing the book, you never get to a point where you haven't done enough research and have to go back and...
No. I'm buried, you know, in stuff by the time I get around to writing the book. You know, I want to, you know, have everything done, you know, so that I don't have to slow down for anything.
So do you think that you'd enjoy killing people in books? Because a lot of people die.
No, actually, I don't. I got to be honest with you. I don't have any kind of cathartic, you know, desire, you know, to go out, you know, and kill people or anything like that. I hear a lot of writers say that, and you know, I don't know. I guess I just haven't had that kind of frustration in my life, you know, to that point. And you know, and I don't hold it against, you know, the characters in my book, the things that they do. I mean, you know, the either good or bad, you know, they're characters, you know, in a book. And so, you know, I mean, sometimes, you know, you'll get to the point where, you know, justice will take a hand, you know, and I think that, you know, that's always going to be the case. But I don't think I ever get any kind of cathartic pleasure out of that, I have to admit.
I think some authors do. I really do.
Oh, yeah. I mean, sure. Like that. You can see it in the writing.
Right. And you're never really that graphic. You paint the scene, but you don't really paint it so people get, oh, now I'm going to throw up, you know.
Yeah,
not that kind of thing.
I'm not a real big one for, you know, really graphic violence or anything like that. To me, that's, you know, probably the least interesting point, you know, in the entire process. For me, the interesting point is what happens afterwards. You know, what are the recriminations of, you know, what happened, and what kind of an effect is it going to have on all of the people that, you know, were affected by this, you know, one instance of, you know,
right,
violence or whatever. To me, it's the aftermath. Great deal more interesting.
Now, is there a junkyard that's in this book? Is it based on one that you've seen?
This book is actually the only book that I've ever taken from my little town of 25, Ucross. There used to be a junkyard here in Ucross that was owned by a fellow by the name of Sonny George, and he had a running battle with the Ucross Foundation, which is an artist's retreat that's over on the other side of Ucross, a couple miles from me. And it's kind of a highfalutin organization that brings in a lot of really high-end painters, musicians, writers. Annie Prue actually finished the Shipping News, you know, at the Ucross Foundation. And they kind of had a running battle between them and the junkyard because they really loved this area and they wanted it to be beautiful, and suddenly there was this junkyard right in the middle of it. And it was our only going industry. But I kind of found that dramatic conflict, you know, interesting. And so whenever I was, you know, looking for a way to illustrate the economy of the, you know, the new American West, it just seems like a way to be able to do that.
Do you want us to feel sorry for Walt Longmire? I always find myself feeling sorry for him every book. He doesn't really have the love. I mean, there's nobody that, I mean, he loves people, but he doesn't seem to have one person that he can love for the rest of his life.
Yeah, I tend to refer to him as the sadder but wiser sheriff, you know, is the way I kind of tend to look at him.
What is his age in these books? I mean, what does it start out in Cold Dish, and what is it in Junkyard Dogs?
Well, chronologically, he should be in his early 60s, but I think he, you know, with homeschooling, you know, and the way that he, you know, graduated from college early, I see him in his late 50s.
Right.
The way that I see him. And I guess, you know, the old saying is, you know, stands true that, you know, that we like people for their virtues, but we love them for their vices.
Right.
You know, and Walt is kind of an example of that, I think. You know, a lot of people, I mean, I get emails every day of people angry at me and saying, you're being too hard on the sheriff. In the next book, make sure you don't beat him up quite so badly. Not only physically, but emotionally.
Yeah, but he gets hurt in this one, and it's really interesting what happens to him. I loved it, and I laughed, and I don't care what people think. I love that part of it.
Well, I think, you know, without giving it away, you know, he
right.
had two injuries that happened to him during the course of this book, but most law enforcement people would say that was not such a hard day. That was a pretty light day, the two things that happened to him. So.
Did you ever know a sheriff like him? Somebody that's close,
you know,
like him?
Actually, there are a lot of sheriffs I know that here in, you know, in Wyoming and up Montana. I do one of the benefits of, you know, having the, you know, books be a success, you know, is that, you know, I get a lot of sheriffs, you know, who write me from all over the country and, you know, want to tell me stories, you know, and you know, want to, you know, talk to me about, you know, the job and what it's like, and because it is a very specific form of law enforcement. It's the only, you know, only elected, you know, form of law enforcement. I mean, if people don't like you, you know, you don't have a job in 4 years. And so that's kind of one of the benefits. And most of the stories that I get, you know, from a lot of these guys, people don't even believe that they're real. The opening scene in the book the one where you know, the older gentleman is actually tied to the back of, you know.
Great scene.
That's a true story. That actually happened.
Do you do that a lot? Put true stories like that in your books?
I do, because I think it's kind of my responsibility as a, you know, I guess a. One of the things, you know, I think that, you know, is missed a lot of times is there are these small, you know, social aspects, you know, these small social histories. And, you know, they don't make it into the great big, you know, textbook, you know, histories, but they do make it into my books. So it's an opportunity to try and get those things in there. I think it also, it kind of grounds the stories. I mean, I don't ever want to write books where Walt is chasing Al-Qaeda in Crook County or something like that. So I want him dealing with the things that, you know, sheriffs deal with.
Well, that's what makes your books unusual. You never know what's coming next. You think you do, but you don't always. And you never know who's going to act weird in this town. I mean, there's a lot of weird people in this town.
There are. And that's kind of one of the things I love about Wyoming is that it's, you know, it can be an odd place. You know, it's a vacuum. There's a lot of empty space here. And so, you know, the odd and the strange kind of tend to float into the vacuum areas. So that's one of the quirky things about the place that I like a lot, I have to.
So is it tough for you when you go to book signings to have all these people around you?
No, not really. I mean, you know, I think it's, you know, maybe it's the other way around because I really enjoy doing the events.
You're the most personable author. I mean, I think I've ever met one of the most personable people. I mean, one meets you and that's the first thing that I'm struck by. You have a great sense of humor. You're just an easygoing guy, and you're not stuck up at all.
Well, I don't know what, you know, I guess. We had the opportunity. As a matter of fact, we were actually there together at the National Book Fest.
Yes, we were.
There was one author where they were driving us back over to the hotel, and this one author threw himself. I'm not going to give away names.
Right.
He threw himself into this chauffeur-driven limousine and said, "Oh my God, signing books and talking all day. I'm just completely exhausted."
I know who that is.
And I remember looking at him and thinking, "You've never had a real job, have you?" Because, you know, to me, this is just, you know, the dream job, you know, of all things. I mean, the chance to get to meet people who, you know, want to read your books, you know, who have read your books and enjoy them and want to talk with you about them. I mean, that's, you know, my God, you know, what's the downside? I don't know what that is, because to me, it's, you know, just a dream come true. I mean, I think about all the authors that, you know, in you know, previous times that have never got to meet their readership, never got to meet the people, you know, who read their books. You know,
right.
I feel like, you know, it's kind of a privilege to be able to do that.
I had when I interviewed one author in particular, but maybe I shouldn't name his name, but when I first called him on the phone, he sounded bored to tears. Like, I have to do this interview. Let's get it done. Let's get it over with. By the time the interview was done, we were having a great time. I won that guy over in the course of an hour. I won him over.
You had to warm up, I guess, to it.
But, you know, but there is something about, I mean, I love the books. I mean, we wouldn't be talking if I didn't love your books. I loved every one of your books. And when authors realize that you really do like the books, you really read them all, as Richard North Patterson said to me one time, "You really have read all my books?" He said, "I don't think I've ever met anybody who's read all my books." I mean, when you take the time to read them, I mean, authors really are moved by that.
Absolutely. Look, it's whenever I meet anybody who's read my books, you know, it's always a situation where I kind of look at each book as kind of a contract. I mean, it's a contract between me and the reader.
You just seem like you have fun writing the books.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, you have a responsibility, you know, to you know, try and do the best job you can, you know, and to make that money that they spent, you know, worthwhile.
But, oh, absolutely.
And try and cover so many different areas, as many different levels as you can, you know, because I think, you know, the people who read crime fiction nowadays, you know, they're a little more sophisticated than perhaps they were, you know, in the past. And I think that they... You know, they come to the game looking for a lot of the same things that they do from, you know, literary fiction or any other form, you know, of literature. You know, they want, you know, fully developed characters. They want an arc of storyline. They want a good plot. They want a good story.
And they want memorable characters, something you're going to remember the next
Absolutely.
Day.
Absolutely. You know, they don't want to put the damn things down, you know, and 6 weeks later wonder what it was that they read.
As I was saying to somebody the other day, they told me they had read a book and they couldn't remember what it was about. I mean, that's the ultimate insult to an author.
That would be that passive reading quality that we were talking about, I think.
I mean, but you wonder what makes... I mean, why are you so good at what you do? That is the question, I guess. I don't know if you can answer that question.
I don't know. You just hope you're doing the best job you can like that. And I think that, you know, you really pay close attention to what you're doing. And above all, do not underestimate, you know, the reader. do not underestimate the people that are going to be reading your books, you know, because they're smart, and they know when you're faking it. They know when you're just going through the motions, and that's pretty important. And I think that that taking it very, very seriously, like that. But then again, it's another thing that you touched upon real quickly there, which was, I enjoy doing this. I really enjoy doing this.
Right.
And so for me, it's when you enjoy doing something, it's always easier.
Well, is the travel rough on you? Traveling from the different.
A little bit. I mean, it seems to get bigger and bigger each year, like that. And this year, the tour.
Well, I hope you're coming to Philly this year because we're looking forward.
Eventually, I will be there because I have a granddaughter there. So.
In fact, I'm not just saying this, but I was leaving the store tonight. One of the employees was reading one of your books. So, how weird is that?
That's a good thing. That's a good thing.
I know the one.
Yes, the big thing for me is that the books have been going over really big in France. Like, and so I've been in France 4 times in the last year.
What is it about France? I'm wondering why they're so popular in France.
I don't know, other than one of the things, once again, that you just said, which is the characters. The characters seem to be have really struck a nerve, as far as the French are concerned. And it's a contemporary American West, and I think it's Walt, it's Henry. I think the Indian characters are a great deal of interest to the French. And then it's also the landscape, though, because they really enjoy reading about the vast open spaces, the American West, that they really just don't have in Europe.
Right.
It doesn't exist.
Now, would you say Walt's an overweight guy?
A little bit.
I mean, if you had to.
A little bit better, since the series started. Like, the series started, he was. The Cold Dish, the first in the series, was basically about the rebirth of this individual. I mean, he had in a lot of ways deadened himself.
Right.
The job, emotionally, to his personal life, to so many things. And it was kind of a story of his coming back to life. And physically, like that, it was a little bit of the same situation. It took him a while to kind of work his way back. Henry stays on him and makes him run periodically, and since he's become more active in his job, he's probably lost a reasonable amount of weight.
Right. But as a writer, can you picture all your characters, what they look like? And
oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So if they ever do a TV movie, you'll be able to say, that's not him, and that's not him. How could they have somebody like that,
That's one of the things, you roll the dice with in those situations, because it's never going to be exactly the way you see it being. And I don't use, I understand that a lot of writers, use actors and actresses, as, caricatures, for, the people that they're writing about. But I have to be honest and say that I don't, because, I don't know those people personally. And for me, it's a situation where I have to know the people personally that I'm writing about. So 9 times out of 10, it's people that I know actually in my life.
Right.
That I've taken just bits and pieces of and done a kind of a Dr. Frankenstein with, because so many little things, can really inform character. I mean, it can be a gesture, it can be a phrase, it can be so many little things that suddenly, they tell you exactly who that character is.
I must thank you, though, for these books, because our thanks to you are we're selling tons of these books at the store. I mean, you're keeping our paychecks coming.
Hey, I'm glad to do it. That's a heck of a bookstore, and an awful lot of nice people, too, so I take that as a...
And do you know, as many people as I've told to read it, I have never had anybody say they didn't like it.
Really?
Never. It has not happened.
That's great.
I think John had one man who said his wife didn't like it.
Okay.
And then I had somebody come back to me and say, well, maybe they're men's books. You must have a lot of women that read your books.
I do. I do have a lot of women who read the books. They, because of the cover art, sometimes I think, some women shy away from them a little bit. But inevitably what I've seen happen is they'll buy them, for their husbands or for their fathers or some, male in their family, and then they'll accidentally pick it up and start reading it and discover, and then they read the rest of the book, which is kind of nice. But I think, what the books are in some sense, my wife tends to refer to them as women's issues books, cleverly disguised as men's, adventure mysteries. Like,
right.
To a certain extent. She may be right about that, because, to me, the female characters are very important in the book. Since the books are, like you said, first person, with Walt telling the story, so there's a really strong masculine narrative, to the stories. And, to help, kind of balance that out, I always try and make sure that the female characters are very strong within the
Well, when you had the idea for Junkyard Dogs, I mean, when you see this idea in your head and you know how it's going to play out, do you see everything? Do you see what's going to happen? Who's the murderer is going to be? What's going to happen in between the beginning and the end? Do you see all that in your head, or do you work that out later?
Yeah, no, I see it. I pretty much sit down and just outline the living daylights out of it and make sure I've got it all down on paper and hopefully in my head before I ever start out, because in a sense I'm trying to write socially responsible, mysteries that have something to say. They've got a message behind them, and generally it's some, issue or something that I'm, dissatisfied with, in our, society and within our culture. And so it's important to me to make sure that I, have that, running throughout the entirety of the book. I mean, one of the biggest statements that you're going to make in a whodunit is going to be whodunit, and so you
right.
damn well better know who that is before you start out.
Right. And what I really, also, the other thing I like about your books is how you feel cold while you're reading them. I mean, you feel like you can feel this winter happening. I mean, it's like I feel like I'm experiencing it. And it
I have written some summer books there, David, just so you know, where you don't have to freeze to death.
Well, that's true, too. But
I mean, the one that takes place there in Philadelphia kind of goes unpunished. That's a spring book, so there's not too much winter.
The thing I like about that book the most is what happens to Katie and just... it's just, is that her name, Katie?
Yeah.
Did I get that right? Oh, I was afraid I had it wrong. But she's in the hospital, and, I love the way you did that. I mean, I like the fact that I don't know what's going to happen to her and whether she's ever going to be normal again.
It was a tough book to write, because, she was kind of incapacitated throughout the majority of the book, but, she also provided, the catalyst, for what it is that Walt gets involved with. But going back to your other statement, I consistently get emails from people in Southern California and Florida who write me and say, I'm sitting here and it's 90 degrees outside and I'm freezing to death reading this damn book.
Right. I don't mind. I love it. I love the feeling because it makes me feel good that it's cold in the book and not really where I am. So I feel good about that.
You guys had a heller of a winter, though, here.
We did. We had a really bad. And that's right when I had my heart attack, right in the middle of that ugly winter, too. So it's like, it just makes it a little bit worse. I mean, you look out the window and it's just snow everywhere, Do you get to read a lot on your own?
I do, because I refuse to give that up, because to me it's kind of a major source of enjoyment. And, and the other thing is I think, the worst thing you can do as a writer is just read yourself. I think that you can get into trouble with that. And I take a great deal of enjoyment in reading, as many writers as I can find, a lot of them, that I think are better the writers than I am. And what that does is I think it kind of makes you, raise your game a little bit, and try and be a better writer,
Absolutely. And you learn new words, too.
Absolutely.
I mean, who doesn't want to learn new words when they're reading a book?
Absolutely.
What do you classify your books as? I mean, do you think would you say they're Western mysteries?
Yeah, I guess they are. I mean, I suppose they are.
Do you have a problem with the word Western?
No, actually, I don't. I don't have any of the problems, with any of the genre labels.
I mean, they're nothing like Matt Dillon, that's for sure.
Yeah, it's not kind of precious. And, whenever somebody says, oh, well, they're Westerns. But I think, as a writer, one of the things you're always shooting for is that universality of, the human experience. I mean, in good writing, you're trying to find what it is that's emblematic of all of us. When a guy is, say a guy's sitting there, at Logan Square, like that, in front of the fountain on the bench there in Philadelphia, and he's reading my book that takes place in Wyoming. I want him to feel a connection, with these characters. I want him to understand what they're going through and why they're going through what they're going through. And so, I think with good literature, that's what you shoot for, is that kind of a universality. And so, in some ways, those precious, little, titles that, different books get, hammered with, like, oh, it's a mystery, oh, it's a Western, oh, those type of things like that. I think that, sometimes those kind of labels, they can kind of, pigeonhole you a little bit. And I don't like that. I like writing out there in the margins. I like, writing about stuff that, maybe pushing the edges a little bit, hopefully.
Now, you...
Are
you still with Mystery Writers? Are you still
in... I am still with Mystery Writers. As a matter of fact, I'm a director at large.
Wow.
Mystery Writers.
That sounds really official. And I'm sure it is. I'm not belittling it.
Where they stick you when they don't know where to put you, I think is what it is.
Is that what it is? But you actually got to judge the Edgars.
I did, actually. I actually judged, But
well, thank you for voting for Stephanie Pintoff. That was a wonderful book. I'm sure she appreciates it, and I do too, because I got an interview with her as a result of it.
Well, good.
And she's a nice lady. But how many books do you read for something like that? I mean, do you read hundreds of them?
Yeah, it's close to like 500 novels.
How can you read that many books?
You just really commit to it for a year. You know, you sit down and every spare moment you've got, you're reading.
But you have to write in the midst of all that, too.
Yeah, you do. You do. You lose that responsibility. The publisher doesn't let you off just because you're doing that. And, it's one of those things where you just kind of have to commit and say, okay, this is one of the things I'm going to do this year with a lot of my time.
Now, do you go to Thriller Fest at all?
No, I don't. I don't, because I don't write thrillers.
Right. Well, I think some of them are thrillers.
Well, that's true. In some ways, they are a little bit.
But I guess their version of and our version of what thrillers are. I mean, what is a thriller anyway? I don't even know myself.
I don't know. I guess a thriller in my limited lexicon would be a book where you already know whodunit, and it's just a question of seeing if they're going to come to justice or not, or if somebody's going to escape.
Well, I think the end of Junkyard Dogs is very thrilling.
Well, yeah. It's also you don't know who the culprit is throughout the majority of the book, and I think in most thrillers you actually do.
Right, and we better not say who it is either. So. I would never be forgiven.
Avoiding saying that. So.
I would never be given. It was almost as bad as me asking Dennis Lehane about his marriage, which I did one time and got in so much trouble for.
Oh no!
Yeah, that was terrible. I literally had to pull it out of the interview, and it was terrible.
Now I really want to know the story.
Well, his publicist called me and said, look, he wants you to take that out. He doesn't want to be asked about his wife. So, and you never know. That's the one of the scary things about interviewing. You never know when you're going to step on a landmine.
Yeah.
And things are going to blow up in your face. And you don't mean it that way. Sometimes you just get curious.
Yeah.
I mean, my intention is not to get anybody's personal life out on
there. Your intentions are to just do a good interview. Yeah.
And nothing can take the fact away that he's a great writer. Do you have a set writing schedule? I mean, do you say I'm going to write a certain number of hours a day and do that, or is it just what comes?
No, I tend to have a set schedule. I've got a ranch. And the old statement about ranches is the animals can't wait.
Right. So, how big is your ranch?
It's about 260 acres.
Oh my goodness! How many?
260.
Wow.
Which is not that big by Wyoming standards, but by my standards.
I would say. Do you cut it yourself?
I do it all myself.
Okay. Do you really?
I'm in the throes of irrigation season right now, or irritation season, as I like to refer to it. But it's one of those things where it gives you a cycle where you're very involved with nature, you're very involved with the outside world. Whenever you do that, and it's an everyday job. The horses need to be fed on Sundays too. So it's not like it's something do part of the week and not do all week. But what that does is it kind of gives me a strict regimen as far as the writing is concerned. And it makes me sit down and it makes me write every day. And I don't have a problem with that because I really enjoy writing. And I'll get going really early in the morning, make a great big pot of coffee and sit down and start writing.
Well, the question is, how do you get everything done? How could you possibly get everything done?
It's tough sometimes. I mean, so obviously sometimes some parts of the year take a lot more time for ranching responsibilities like that. And then other times in the winter, the majority of the really deep winter, I get the animals all fed and everything taken care of early in the morning, and then I don't have anything to do until that evening. So it gives me all day every winter.
So what does that entail? Getting up what time in the morning?
Usually I'm up around at least by 6.
Wow.
Getting everything done.
That's not too bad.
By about 7:30, 8 o'clock.
And you don't, and I don't hear any stress in your voice at all. So, I mean,
it's stuff that I'm familiar with and have been familiar with my entire life. So it's not anything that's too difficult.
Now, I assume you already have an idea for the next book, or are you already done the next book?
Yeah, the next one's actually already, I've got the first draft on it already done.
Wow. Are you allowed to tell us the title?
Oh, sure. The title is actually Hell is Empty.
And it's Hell is Empty? Ooh.
Hell is Empty, like that. And it comes from Shakespeare's The Tempest, like that, in Act 1, Scene 2, like that, where Prospero's making the comment when he sees the ship breaking up on the horizon and all the survivors are swimming towards his island, and he says, "Hell is empty and the devils are all here."
Oh, what a great line.
The book is, you know, basically, it's probably the closest to a thriller that I've written, you know, now that we've discussed that.
But right, exactly.
In essence, what happens is Walt becomes involved, you know, with an exhumation of a body up on the Bighorn Mountains, and there's a private transport van full of, you know, convicts. And, you know, of course, it's like in, you know, early in the spring, and there's an ice storm, and, you know, they escape. And he's the only guy there to go after them, and so he does. And the entire book is something of a, I guess, of an analogy for, or a metaphor rather, of Dante's Inferno. In the book, what happens is that Santiago Cesar Vitoria, the Basque deputy, is, you know, becomes relatively dissatisfied with his criminal justice degree, and makes the remark, and he gets really sick and tired of all of Walt's literary allusions that he makes during the course, you know, of the book.
Hmm.
He finally says to him, he says, "Well, look, I want everybody in the office, you know, to make a list of 10 books that I should have read, you know, when I was in college but didn't." And so, you know, Walt has pity on him and gives him things like, you know, The Three Musketeers, you know, and, you know, To Kill a Mockingbird. But, of course, you know, Ruby, on the other hand, the dispatcher, doesn't have any, you know, doesn't make it any easier for him and gives him things like, you know, the Pilgrim's Progress and, and Dante's Inferno, like that. And so he's struggling his way through Dante's Inferno, and there's a point in the book whenever Walt gets ready to leave and go after these guys, he throws a backpack on his back.
Maybe I should read Dante's Inferno before I read your book.
And then what happens is Cesar Vitoria takes the paperback of Dante's Inferno and stuffs it, you know, into Walt's pack and says, "I know you hate to go anywhere without a book here." And so what happens is the story kind of, you know, it kind of, you know, threads its way, you know, along, very much like Dante's Inferno, his trip through hell.
Do you ever get any other authors that come up to you and tell you they read your books?
Yeah, I do, yeah. And that's nice, you know, because a lot of times it's authors that, you know, I myself enjoy. So.
That's got to be a thrill for you, just to know. There we go with that word thrill again. I'm overusing that word today. I can't even believe I'm using it because you don't even write thrillers. We've already established this. You're really quite a fun guy. I mean, you're always, I always know that when I talk to you, I'm going to have a good time talking to you. That really means a lot.
Thank you. Thank you.
I mean, and how many people can you say that's true of?
It's a limited number, I got to admit.
It is. I mean, you really have taken life and made it a lot of fun. Do you have any fears as a writer at all?
You know, I think when I started out, I had more. And the big one was when, you know, Penguin came back, when Catherine Court, the president of Penguin, cornered me in her office like that and said, "Okay, we would like you to do this as a series." And that, you know, really scared me pretty bad because, you know, as a writer, you don't want to end up doing the same thing over and over again. That's kind of...
But that's not what you're doing, though.
At that point in time, though, I wasn't quite sure that would be the case. You know, I didn't know if I would be capable of, you know, reinventing the wheel, you know, every month.
That must have been,
every 12 months.
So you were pretty scared at that point. What am I going to do? How am I going to do?
Yeah. And so it was a little intimidating because, I mean, I didn't even know if I could write a second book. I hadn't done it yet, you know, and so writing it about Walt, you know, and Absaroka County and Wyoming and all of that, you know, I didn't know if it would work or not. I didn't know if I could do it. And so that was a little worrisome. And then after I wrote a couple, I felt like, you know, well, yeah, you can do this and keep it fresh, you know, and continue to allow the characters to evolve and change. I think that, you know, I mean, I've had, you know, relative success with the books, but certainly not any kind of landslide success where I could be trapped by one book. I mean, I think for a lot of authors, they have that one breakout book, you know, that really, you know, explodes, and then they kind of get trapped, you know, with the formula of that book and continue to write that book maybe for the rest of their careers. And then there have been other authors that I've read, you know, where they start out really well, you know, as far as the series is concerned, but then you read that, you know, fourth or fifth or sixth book, and, you know, you start thinking, you know, it feels like they've kind of run out of gas on this idea.
You know, and it's interesting, because I can't even imagine your books being mass market paperbacks, because they've always been trade. I'm so used to seeing a trade version of your book.
Yeah, they are.
Did they ever talk about doing mass markets for them?
No, they actually haven't. I think that, you know, they're going to, you know, keep me in the trade paperback purview, you know, which is, you know, fine by me.
I like it too. Yeah, I like the printing on the books. I've always liked the printing.
I have to admit that I'm getting to the age now where, like, if they make the print any smaller, I'm not going to be able to read my own books. You know, so I got to be.
So, have you done everything in your life you've wanted to do so far?
Oh, I don't think anybody could ever do everything in their life they wanted to.
I mean, if I said to you, go out right now and do the one thing you've always wanted to do that you haven't done, what would it be?
Well, I mean, that varies every day. Like, that changes every day. But I did have an interesting experience. I was over in Saint-Malo, up in Brittany in France, and my wife and I were sitting there having a cup of coffee in the morning, and I looked, and there were, you know, all these motorcycles lined up out there, and I looked at her, and I said, you know what, that's something I'd like to do. Hop on a motorcycle and go all over Europe and just see what that's like. And
wow.
She looked at me and she said, you're getting too old for that. And, you know, there's always that moment when somebody says that to you, but the even worse moment is when you concede the fact that they might be right, you know?
Yeah, but you're so, I mean, when one meets you, and you're very youthful. I mean, you don't seem like you wouldn't be able to do that. You seem like you're a go-getter.
It might be her trying to, like, you know, keep me from doing it, too. Like, she doesn't like motorcycles at all.
Should we say that? I should say, should you say that? No, but I mean, yeah, I hear what she's saying, but I don't agree. I think you could make it easily.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, don't be surprised, you know, if we talk again next year and I've gone all over Europe on a motorcycle.
There you go. I'm looking forward to hearing about it now. Just think of the fun you'd have, though.
Absolutely.
I mean, why wouldn't you? And think of all the ideas you'd come home with.
I know.
By that time, you'd have... Do you keep, like, a notebook and put ideas down when you get an idea?
Always. Everywhere. I have notepads and papers with me all the time. Like, and I've got, you know, huge files of, you know, newspaper articles, magazine articles. Because 9 times out of 10, that's generally where the ideas for my novels come from. There'll be, a newspaper article that will address, you know, some sort of social issue. Or else there'll be an event, it'll be a catalyst that I think, you know, I can utilize to you know, have as a vehicle for one of the ideas for the story or
right.
Something like that. But yeah, I don't trust my memory, you know, to the point where I don't, you know, write everything down and try and, you know.
Maybe you should have one of those recorders and take it with you too.
Well,
and just...
I tried that, but I felt so idiotic, you know, doing
it. Did you really?
Note to self, you know.
I don't think that's idiotic. I think it's organized. It's an organized.
I think it was that, and listening to my own recorded voice was just more than I could bear.
And what do you really care what other people think anyway? Why should you?
That's true.
I mean, within reason, of course. I'm not saying you should go out streaking or something, but, you know, there is a point. I understand exactly what you're talking about, because I hate to hear my own voice. I mean, I listen to these. I can barely listen to these interviews because I hear my voice and I hate it. And I have no idea why I hate my voice. It seems to be built into most people. I just, will this series go on and on and on? Do you see writing 30 books?
You know, I have no idea. I have no idea.
Would you ever write another series?
I don't know if I would ever write another series. I mean, I've got other, you know, standalone pieces that I'm working on now.
Oh, you might write a standalone. Oh, that'd be cool.
Yeah, I've got some standalone pieces that I've already even, you know, gotten going. Like that, you know.
And they'll be nothing like the Walt Longmires at all?
Not particularly. I don't think they are. Like that. But I don't know. I see myself. I mean, I enjoy writing this series. I'm having a good time doing it.
Well, we enjoy reading them. I mean, I'm amazed that you're not more well known than you are.
So I appreciate that. Like, it's, you know, it's just one of those things though where I think that the point, if it ever came to a point where I did feel as though, you know, I was running out of gas, or that, you know, that I really didn't have anything more to say with these characters, then I would have to seriously consider whether it is that I wanted to continue with them or not.
Right.
But, you know, until then, you know, I mean, as long as I'm having a good time and as long as I feel as though the characters and the place have something, you know, pertinent to say.
Yeah, you don't want to be one of the, I mean, there's a certain author, and I won't tell you, I won't name the name because I don't want to hurt their feelings. But I've heard that they'll say, well, that series went on too long, and it's just, they, you know, it just becomes, it's not fun to read anymore. It's just
right.
the same old stuff over and over again. And then
yeah.
You never want to get to that point. You always want to be fresh and
right.
and new.
Absolutely.
But it isn't easy.
At that point, if you discover that that's the case, then, oh, my God, turn it off.
Is there a possibility that those standalones will be published?
Oh, yeah. I've got great hopes that they will be. I mean, they're not finished or anything, you know, so I've still, you know, got a lot of work to do on them. But I think that's also a good thing as far as the process is concerned. I think that, you know, you can get, you know, a little stale writing the same characters in the same place over and over and over again without, you know, branching out and doing some different stuff. I think that's pretty essential as a writer, I think.
Absolutely. And you've written short stories before, haven't you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But actually, I have a short story that I write, and I've written short stories, and then there's also an entire collection of Walt Longmire short stories, because every Christmas is like the halfway point between books. And so every Christmas I send out, you know, along with my posted newsletter, I send out a Christmas story about Walt. And those seem to have, you know, gotten quite a following like that. So.
You might as well tell people where it is so that they know where your website is.
You know what? I don't have the short stories on there, as a matter of fact.
Oh. So they have to get them by email.
They have to get them by email. They can contact me and I can get them to them like that. And then also there's a little publisher, small press publisher out of Southern California by the name of ASAP Publishing, and they're going to be doing an entire collection of all the short stories.
Wow.
Yeah.
Will that be available in bookstores? I mean, all the bookstores?
I don't know, because it's a limited run. You know, it's like a really high quality.
Well, I want one.
Limited run deal. But I'm most certainly have that information on the website whenever I get around to
it. Life is just so much fun for you. It's so nice to hear somebody who's just so nice enjoying their life like this. I mean, really, it really is nice that this is happening for you, and I really feel good for you.
Well, it's, you know, it is. I got no complaints. I really don't. Other than getting the phone to work, you know, here at the ranch.
And why complain? All it is more aggravation. Why would you want to complain anyway? It doesn't do any good anyway.
Exactly.
Who's going to listen to you anyway?
That's right.
Well, we've been talking to Craig Johnson. This has been wonderful, Craig. I really appreciate this. The new book's called Junkyard Dogs. It's out from Viking, Penguin, and all your bookstores in hardcover right now, even as we speak. And this has been David's Book Talk, and we will talk to you next time.